Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Flames in the Sky by Pierre Klosterman, narrated by Julian Elfer. Preface. In 1946, I began to realize a project which I had set my heart on as early as 1940, the history of the war in the air. I have worked through hundreds and thousands of documents from the archives of the Luftwaffe, the Air Ministry, and the United States Navy and Army Air Forces. I have read, roughly speaking, all the translations of Japanese documents collected together by the Pentagon in Washington, all the books published in America, France, England, Switzerland, Italy, and Spain. Already the fruits of 5 years of patient research have accumulated, and in a few months, if events permit, the book will be ready. It is now, nearly at the end of this task, that I have suddenly become aware of the very grave danger to which the historian of this war is exposed by the very nature of the vast documentation at his disposal. When everything had been digested, classified, annotated, drafted, I realized that out of that sum total of individual exploits, acts of courage, often anonymous, sacrifices by men of every race and creed, nothing is left in the end but a mass of papers, maps, photos, figures and statistics. The human lessons are hidden by the strategic lessons. The skill of human hands and the bravery of human hearts disappear in the cold-blooded study of materials and technique. Heroism is masked behind the communiques and the operational reports. And yet, what stories of sublime courage and energy the historian discovers as he pores over the columns of figures in the frightening balance sheet of modern air war. Debit, credit, aircraft lost, tons of bombs, enemy destroyed, ships sunk, killed, wounded, missing, total, year, is nothing to emerge from the gigantic drama of the 1939-45 war but blueprints and reports on industrial organization? Such an idea is revolting. Are we to forget that under the tons of debris and the devastated towns, homes were crushed by the bombs? Are we to forget that under the charred and twisted wreckage of aircraft, it was human flesh burnt? It was men who suffered in the sky as they handled those masterpieces of modern technique. It was men who perished in terrible suffering to carry out the plans of the strategists. It was men who sacrificed themselves so that others might live. It was men, too, who went through hell to redeem the military and political mistakes of some and save the honor of others. Is it by making people study graphs and curves of consumption that we shall teach them to hate war and to respect those who have been through it? That is why I felt I must, here and now, relate these few stones of flying men culled from among hundreds and thousands of others which will be buried in ministerial archives and historical research departments. They are neither finer nor stranger than those which will remain unknown. I have chosen them rather haphazardly, merely because they are typical of certain phases of the war and of certain theatres of operations. Each of these stories gives the feel of a particular aspect of the war in varying latitudes and circumstances. Their only common factor is the courage and idealism of those whose lives they relate, and they show above all that under different guises the highest virtues of man are the prerogative of no single nation. In each of these stories I have begun with a brief sketch of the main lines of the campaign in question, so that the listener can understand the action involved in its right perspective and against the right background. Since for a great number of readers some of the campaigns, that in the Pacific for instance, were in the nature of things rather distant, I have thought it advisable to describe also those important actors, the aircraft themselves. For a pilot, every plane has its own personality, which always reflects that of its designers and colours the mentality of those who take it into action. The Spitfire, for instance, is typically British. Temperate, a perfect compromise of all the qualities required of a fighter, ideally suited to its task of defence. An essentially reasonable piece of machinery conceived by cool, precise brains and built by conscientious hands. The Spitfire left such an imprint on those who flew it that when they changed to other types, they found it very hard to get acclimatized. Certain aircraft will also go down to history as classics, typifying their epoch. The 1914-18 war calls to mind the Spad, the Breguet 14, the de Havilland DH-4, the Fokker and the Gotha. My generation, i.e. the 1939-45 generation, will immediately think of the Spit, the Moraine 406, the Stuka, the Messerschmitt 109, the Mosquito, the Yak, the Zero, the Fortress, and the Two-Tailed Lightning. Each of these planes has its tale of technical troubles, disappointments, and successes, of tactics imposed upon it by its design, and above all, of affection or dislike of those who flew it. Pierre Klostermann. Chapter 1. Prelude. 12th of May 1940, Maastricht. During the night and in the early morning, there were important enemy movements in the Ardennes region and towards the west. The columns include bridging crews. Large motorized armored forces are on the march towards the Meuse, coming respectively from Dinan, Givet, and Neufchâteau. Our reconnaissance reports, in addition, strong columns on the roads on the general axis Maastricht-Tongres. Intelligence summary, 12th of May, 1940. The storm coming from the east spread its flood over Flanders and the north of France. The hordes of refugees on the march ran up against our tangled and already disorganized military convoys coming up to stem the enemy tide. And already, infiltrating through the cracks in our hills, spreading over the plains, bypassing the towns, driving onward on a rattle of tracks and a stench of diesels, the panzer divisions were about to fall upon France. Drifting on the east wind, the long white condensation trails crisscrossed the blue spring sky, and over the green countryside stretched the shadow of the long black smoke trails of the invasion. The men, huddled in the ditches, shook their fists at the sky. The swine. The swine were the Stukas, tumbling down like an avalanche. First a few black spots up there in the sky and a distant roar, then down they spiraled one after the other, and above the crescendo of the engines came the scream of the bombs. The W-shaped wings with their flaps and dive brakes, perched on the two slender legs of the undercarriage, the yawning gape of the radiator, all that came smack down into your eyes with a roar like the Day of Judgment. The men were left dazed and quivering. A few cars were burning on the road, and from some useless overturned B-2 came a whiff of burnt rubber and roasted flesh. The swine. And that included their own aircraft, whose wings they could see burning in a field, and also those who were getting massacred high up and far away, trying to make some impression on this terror which flowed over the roads and fell upon them from the sky. The long Dornier 17s were still slipping westwards, and from the bellies of the serried squadrons of Heinkel 3s fell the sticks of bombs pirouetting down to smash stations and villages. Up above, the angry buzz of the Messerschmitt 110s keeping watch, and all around the clumps of Messerschmitt 109s with their yellow bellies and their clipped wings scouring the sky. Black crosses, nothing but black crosses. In spite of that, at every crossroad in the villages submerged by the armoured columns, on the banks of the Meuse, perched on the piles of the demolished bridges, the long tubes of the German 37mm guns were springing up, pointing skywards. At road junctions, the half-tracks of the flak service were taking up position and setting up their multiple 20mm mountings. The clips of shells were lined up by the roadsides, and the spotters kept a lookout from the banks, rangefinders at the ready. It was at Maastricht that the first blow of the battering ram fell. The narrow streets of the little Dutch town overflowed with the continuous flood of tanks and trucks crawling along the banks of the Meuse to the pontoon bridge thrown across alongside the collapsed railway viaduct by the German engineers. All that swarm of vehicles flooded onto the roads to Tongres and Bilsen and poured in an endless stream over the intact bridges across the Albert Canal at Veldwezelt and Vroonhoven. A few miles to the south, the fort of Ibn Emil, its glacis covered with variegated parachutes and capped with smoke, had just succumbed. The haggard defenders came stumbling out of the shattered casemates and staggered down to the plain, picking their way between the carcasses of the gliders and covered by the submachine guns of the enemy parachutists. On the dark waters of the canal, the empty rubber dinghies of the special assault troops drifted away. Inside those few square miles, bounded to the west by the Albert Canal, that gigantic and useless anti-tank ditch, to the north by the Meuse and the Maastricht Canal, and to the southeast by the Jar, meandering through the flooded fields, seven panzer divisions concentrated. Directed one by one by the sweat and dust-covered Wehrmacht traffic policemen, over the bridges still standing, the tanks and the six-wheeled armored cars slowly crossed, their long antennae waving, But once over, the tanks accelerated in a roar of exhausts, churning up the macadam with their steel tracks. The impregnable defences had crumbled, the infallible plans had been torn to shreds, the comprehensive measures had been swept aside. It was then, to put off the inevitable, that our fighters and bombers were cruelly thrown into the furnace, in pathetic driblets. Who could have seen them, lost as they were in the vast sky? Those poor French planes which took off on clear mornings in May 1940 and never came back, pounced on by the Messerschmitts or picked off by the flak. Yes, the flak. For already this was a nightmare for the pilots, the little guns of the automatic flak with their long venomous barrels spitting up strings of steel pearls which sliced off your wings and blinded you. Every German battalion brought reinforcements to the flak as it passed. The quadruple 20mm anchored themselves between the poplars on the banks, and more 37mm were unloaded from the trucks. The gun crews in shirt sleeves piled up the ammunition and stumbled over the heaps of empties. The observation post was perched high up the chimney of some brickworks, and the battery commanders scanned the Meuse Valley through their glasses. There was a flak emplacement every 50 yards along the 3 miles of the canal, from the Vroonhoven Bridge to the Veldwezel Bridge. Protected by them, the convoys of troop-laden trucks passed through in an endless stream. There was no risk anyway, for the Luftwaffe was mistress of the sky. The two previous alerts had proved it. The Belgian ferry battles of the Hipsey flight, reinforced by the Pierre flight, had taken off from Eltre between Ghent and Bruges. The three sections of three aircraft dived through a terrific flak barrage, only to be picked up by the watchful Messerschmitts. 6 planes out of the 9 were shot down. With sublime courage, 2 pilots, Captain Glory and Sergeant Delvine, whose bombs had not fallen on the first run over the target, came back a second time into the furnace and crashed in flames. The bridges were still intact. A few hours later, the RAF had a try. The 8 Hurricanes of No. 1 Squadron, commanded by squadron leader Bull Hallahan, took off to keep the Messerschmitts out of the way, while 6 ferry battles of Bomber Command tried to destroy at least the Veldwezel Bridge. They ran into the Messerschmitt 109s from Aix-la-Chapelle, Hin, Hornbudberg, Gladbach and Vogelsand, more than 120 fighters. The rendezvous with the bombers was at 9:15. It was 9:12. 3 minutes left to clear the way for the bombers. The Hurricanes went for the Messerschmitts, bald-headed, and were soon struggling heroically against the angry pack. Hallahan's plane exploded and his parachute opened in the nick of time over the canal. Flying Officer Lewis came down soon after. 3 Messerschmitt 109s were destroyed, but the RAF fighters were overcome by superior numbers and 4 others were shot down. The diversion did, however, produce the desired effect. The 6 battles dived straight into the flak, straightening out a few yards from the bridge. 3 bombs scored hits, but 3 plants were shot down. A 4th, piloted by Flight Lieutenant Garland, the flight leader, crashed straight into the bridge, which collapsed in a shower of spray. The 5th spiraled down, 1 wing torn off. The 6th managed to get home, escorted by the 2 surviving Hurricanes. The fields roundabout were strewn with charred carcasses of aircraft, crumpled wings, shattered fuselages, pathetic bits of aluminium surrounded by circles of dead grass, blackened by oil and flames from the gutted fuel tanks. Occasionally, a few German sappers would hastily dig a trench where the poor smashed bodies of the pilots were laid, wrapped in the silk of their parachutes. Then, once again, the white alarm rockets announcing a new sacrifice. Blasts on whistles and the shrill hooters of the Flugalarm. Before the aircraft were even visible, the 200 barrels of the flak reared up and opened fire, a prodigious drum roll as a prelude to the execution. Wreaths of smoke ran along the towpaths, and 1,000 dazzling parabolas of 20mm tracer shells formed a mosaic of black and grey bursts. The trucks had stopped. The soldiers in their field grey clung to the running boards and looked round questioningly. Suddenly the drivers switched off and jumped into the ditches, the men crouched down behind the trees. 6 aircraft swept up like whirlwinds from behind the brick steeples of Maastricht. They were the Brugge 693s of Fighter Squadron, 1 54 mid-wing monoplanes with twin Gnome Rhone engines, fuselages shaped like tadpoles and twin fins set high on the tailplanes. Starting from a perfect right echelon formation, they fanned out in a deafening roar. Each aircraft climbed steeply through the streams of tracer, its identification markings showing up clearly on the grey fuselage. They levelled out, then dived hell for leather, bomb bays open. The first, number 49, one engine already in flames, let go its six light bombs, which ricocheted and exploded among the camouflaged lorries. Like a comet dragging a long, fiery tail, it turned, and its heroic pilot came back, enfilading the road with his cannon and his fixed machine guns. Rolling from side to side, out of control, it broke away and crashed in a terrific shower of sparks on top of a group of armoured cars, which were ground into the dust by the impact of the six-ton plane going at 300 miles per hour. Breguet number 21 came in flat out, let go its bombs, and then levelled out over the canal, hugging the water and pursued by black bursts. On the way, it machine-gunned two flak emplacements whose crews collapsed over the guns. It got away. The third plane attacked through the incandescent ribbons which scored the sky. The flak guns strewed its path with thousands of fragments of steel. Among the crash of the bombs and the roar of engines, four sharp metallic cracks rang out. Four hits on the slender wings, four trails of smoke. The Breguet immediately burst into flames like a torch. The pilot switched off his engines, lowered his flaps, and went into a violent sideslip and belly-landed in a marshy field with a scream of metal. There was a lull in the flak. The gunners looked round, wondering, what next? A new flight of three Breguets, numbers 7, 9, and 4, which had feinted towards Tongres, came back at right angles to the congested enemy columns, so low that they seemed to be slipping from one field into the next. Taking advantage of the lull, they shot between the trees, dropped their bombs, and let fly with their guns, and then jumped the row of poplars. But the flak had the last word all the same, for two of them were disgorging a heavy stream of black smoke. More Breguets arrived, soon caught in the impenetrable meshes of the flak. The wings of number 14 were torn to ribbons, and the machine, its ailerons gone, and now quite unmanageable, crashed into the trees by the roadside, bounced and hit the ground in a cloud of dust which was soon fringed with flame. Number 19, a river of fire 20 yards long issuing from its punctured tanks, suddenly climbed vertically, and two dark shapes emerged from the cockpit and started spinning down. Two parachutes opened out, apparently fixed in space, while the plane flicked over and went into a spin. The last of the Breguet, number 22, engines flat out, dived desperately in turn, multicoloured tracer whipping under its fuselage. It dropped its bombs diagonally across a park of artillery tractors. Then it was hit, wobbled, and fragments of aluminium torn off by the bullets fluttered in its slipstream. But miraculously it got through and vanished into the dense smoke of the fires raging all along the road. That was the end. 100 or so vehicles were blazing away on the road, their burning fuel eating into the tar. The sky was bespattered with bursts in thick clumps and criss-crossed with grey smoke trails. Through the roar of the column, getting underway, could be heard from the Tongres direction the muffled rattle of the flak, baying after the surviving Breguet. Once again the tanks and trucks were irresistibly on the move. 8 aircraft for 4 minutes respite. The flak stayed in position and the sacrifice went on. In the course of the afternoon, the RAF, following the heroic French fighter pilots from 154, made another effort to halt the avalanche of enemy armour from Maastricht. Collecting all its available ferry battles, it sent them into the fray. 67 planes started, 31 came through, most of them so severely damaged that they were unable to get back to England. Later on, it was the turn of the Loiret et Olivier 45s, while our Curtises, our Duvotines, and our Morane tried to get their teeth into the formations of Dornier. The Messerschmitt's death dance went on in our skies just the same. 1,000 successes, but also 500 pilots massacred because they were too few and it was too late. The flames spread from one sky to another, from the yellow plains of Poland to the green Vosges, from the soot of London to the snows of Russia, and from the blue of the Pacific to the ice of Alaska. Too little, too late. Chapter 2. Pearl Harbor and Bataan. Too little, too late. The tragedy of France and the Low Countries, the result of our superiority complex, improvisation, complacency, administrative chaos, and improvidence, was to be repeated for the Americans when the Japanese attacked on the 7th of December 1941. There too, cheese-pairing while the spectre of war loomed large on the horizon, the hope of a problematical appeasement by dint of concessions, outworn tactical and strategical ideas, were to exact a heavy price in unnecessary sacrifices and lost lives. Luckily for the United States, just as England had the Channel, they had the vast Pacific Ocean between their territory, their factories and their people, and the empire of the rising sun. We French had only the Rhine and the Meuse. The Pearl Harbor disaster, which has been the subject of the most gigantic official inquiry in history, the record of the proceedings runs to over 20,000 pages, deserves a book to itself. The mystery of the Japanese code, of President Roosevelt's foreknowledge of the enemy plans, of all that went on in the White House, will presumably one day be revealed. That is not the object of this story, but nevertheless certain features of that Japanese operation must be mentioned, and also a brief sketch made of the air battles over the Philippines, in order that the listener may appreciate the epic story of the 24th Interceptor Group of the USAF in Bataan from Christmas 1941 to the end of March 1942. Pearl Harbor, 7th of December 1941. It was Sunday morning, the first Sunday after payday for the GIs and sailors of the base. All night the dance halls and bars of Pearl Harbor had been turning people away. The fleet had come in the day before, apart from the aircraft carriers, and Hawaii had been the scene of the usual junketings on the first Saturday in the month. There were few people still up at 3:45 a.m., apart from the poker addicts and those wending their way back to their mess. In a tent on a hillside overlooking the misty sea, an alarm clock went off. Technical Corporal Third Class Joe Lockhart and Private George Elliott climbed grumblingly out of their damp blankets and, after a quick wash, went to their post in the chilly morning air. By their tent stood a large square steel trailer with narrow slatted windows. On the roof, covered with a tarpaulin, which the men carefully removed, was a large parabolic aerial shaped like an electric bowl fire. It was one of the three SCR-260B experimental radar sets which had arrived from England. Nobody had much faith in this queer British contraption. Joe Lockhart, an amateur radio fan in private life, was the only one, or at any rate one of the few, for whom the apparatus was now practically an open book. The radar sets had arrived in July and had been on the go continuously from the 10th of November to the 3rd of December, whenever an alarm warning had been given. Handled as they were by inexpert crews, they had begun to go wrong, and there were now only three spare cathode ray tubes. HQ had decided to use them only from 1 hour before dawn till 1 hour after sunrise, i.e. about from 4 to 7 a.m. It wasn't much fun being on duty in this remote spot, and in those conditions while the other fellows had all the Hawaii hotspots at their disposal and lived in air-conditioned barracks. They had switched on and the radar was warming up. Lockhart was keeping an eye on the hypnotizing dance of the oscilloscope. He busied himself plotting the permanent interference to hand in at the next weekly inspection, if the officer on duty didn't forget. Now and then Elliot asked if there weren't at long last any blips to see. Lockhart did not even bother to reply. Blips? What blips? There were never any planes up, so there couldn't be any blips, especially on a Sunday. The radiant sun dispersed the mist and rose over the peaceful, flower-decked island. At 6:45, Lockhart suddenly saw a very faint blip appear on the extreme edge of the screen, right at the top, bearing 330 degrees. At 6:55, the blip, which seemed to be zigzagging slowly, coming back on itself and then going north again, became quite clear for a moment. Lockhart, without warning Elliot, who was busy outside with the generator, put a call through to control over the normal line. After a 5-minute wait, he was put through to a duty officer who took a dim view of the whole thing and told him pretty sharply to mind his own business. Out of a sense of duty, Lockhart made a note of the tracks and the times. At 6:58, the blip, still very faint, disappeared completely. At 7 o'clock, as per instructions, Lockhart switched off and locked up the trailer. The two men stood waiting for the truck which was to take them back to the mess for breakfast when they heard the phone go. It was to tell them they couldn't get picked up till 7:30. Lockhart, furious and having nothing better to do, went back to his radar and switched it on again while Elliot put a shine on his shoes in a corner. 7:02. "Hi, George, come over here, quick." Elliot rushed over. "Look." A miracle. For the first time for 3 months since they had been looking after that radar set, here was an honest-to-goodness blip, perfectly sharp. The big, transparent green blip was moving fast southwards towards Hawaii. Plot it. Elliot quickly placed a round sheet of transparent squared paper over the map stuck a pin through the middle over where their station was, and got ready to take down the dope. 7:02, point 1:30. That was where they were when I first saw them. Probably Navy planes, thought Elliot, from an aircraft carrier on manoeuvres out at sea, bringing ashore officers who wanted to spend a Sunday with their families. But they generally operated south of the island. Takedown, 7:04, 1:32. Elliot did a quick calculation on a special slide rule. The planes were going about 225 miles per hour. Lockhart kept his eye on the bright dot quivering on the screen and hesitated. Would he get bawled out again? He unhooked the special phone on the direct line to control at Fort Shafter, reserved for urgent messages. Only after furiously winding the handle for several minutes did he hear the receiver being lifted at the other end. He recognized the voice. Hello, MacDonald, is that you, Joe? Yeah. Lockhart here, from Epona Station. Find me someone at Central Control, it's very important. There ain't no one here anymore. The place shuts at 7, didn't you know? Say, listen, MacDonald, be a pal and find me an officer. Anyone will do. 3 minutes passed, while the blips got bigger and started to split up as they got nearer. Then a curt voice spoke into the phone. Lieutenant Tyler here, duty officer. Lockhart here, Lieutenant, with the SCR at Epona. I have spotted an important formation of planes making for Hawaii. At 0702 hours, they were 136 miles away and bearing 0 to 10 degrees. The voice was perplexed and hesitant. Okay, I've got it. Don't worry, it's okay. The duty officer hung up. At 7:28, the signs got lost in the fringe of permanent blips. The formation of aircraft was only 22 miles away. At 7:30, the truck picked up Elliot and Lockhart, but they were fated not to get their breakfast that day. At 7:57, on the glass-fronted balcony of the tall control tower on Hickam Airfield, overlooking the naval base, Colonel Bertolf, who was worrying about the arrival of 16 flying fortresses coming from San Francisco, suddenly leapt to his feet. In his binoculars, he could see a long line of black dots. Aircraft approaching Kauai. There were about 50 of them, all single-engined. The colonel turned to the controller and asked him if they were Navy aircraft. Without even looking up, he answered that it was unlikely so early on a Sunday morning. A few moments later, the planes began to peel off one by one and dive on Pearl Harbor. Showers of spray arose among the ships of the line, jammed tightly together and powerless to move. It was the Japs. At 6 in the morning, Vice Admiral C. Nagumo, commanding the 1st Air Fleet detailed for the attack on Pearl Harbor, had hoisted the Z flag on the mast of the aircraft carrier Akagi. It was the original flag hoisted by Togo at Tsushima in 1905, when he won the first great naval battle of modern times, brought on board the flagship in a lacquer and gold casket. Z. Attack! To fulfill his mission, Nagumo had under his command 6 aircraft carriers protected by 9 destroyers, 2 heavy cruisers and 2 battleships. His 6 aircraft carriers, with their romantic names, were the Akagi, Red Castle, the Shokaku, Climbing Crane, the Zuikaku, Happy Crane, the Kaga, Increasing Joy, the Soryu, Green Dragon, and the Hiryu, Flying Paragon. The squadron's senior navigation officer had surpassed himself in spite of the bad weather which had prevented him from verifying his positions and his time scheduled by the stars. At 0 hour, the exact position for launching the attack, latitude 26 degrees north, longitude 128 degrees north, had been reached. The first wave comprised 90 Kates, 40 equipped with special torpedoes driven by oxygen and the others with 1,000-pound bombs, and 50 Val dive bombers, the whole escorted by 50 Zeros. This first formation was entrusted with the principal task, i.e. the sinking of the American battle fleet. The second wave, whose task was to neutralize the airfields, comprised 50 Kates, 80 Vals and 40 Zeros. At 7:56, the war between the United States and Japan began. In the officers' club at the Great Wheeler Airfield, a poker game was just finishing. The previous evening, Saturday, 6th of December, there had been a dinner dance and the game had begun at 1 a.m, when most of the guests went home. At 6 in the morning, play was still going on at one solitary table, and half an hour later, 2 young Air Force lieutenants, cleaned out to the last cent by 3 Navy officers, went out for a breath of air. What was there to do so early on a Sunday morning? Lieutenants Welch and Taylor were muzzy with alcohol and cigarette smoke. They decided to have an invigorating bathe in the sea, followed by a few hours' sleep on the warm sands of Haleiwa Beach by their airfield. Their car was the only one left in the car park. In front of them stretched the runways or wheeler field covered with aircraft. For a moment they admired the 75 magnificent Curtiss P-40s just out of their crates, parked...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?